The word eschatology means that discipline which is a study of the last things, Greek eschatos, the last or the end, a study of those things which will happen at the end of the world. It's a very important part of Christian theology, eschatology, because the focus of the Christian gospel is not now, but then. The center of gravity of our message is not, as few people seem to realize, is not this world as present constituted, but a future world and our life in it. We are said to be heirs. We're coming into a great inheritance, but what is it? We're said to be pilgrims on a journey to a city, to a destination, but what is the destination? Where are we going? Obviously, after death, we're said to be aliens, although we may have our citizenship and do, of course, in the United States of America, or some of you come from other countries. But nevertheless, if you're a Christian, there's a greater citizenship that you have of another kingdom to which we are all going. We are, to use the old word, sojourners, pilgrims, temporary residents. So what is it all leading up to? What is coming? Well, of course, if we read many theology books or Christian gospel books or hear many preachers and teachers, it seems like the last chapter is heaven. You trust Christ, give your life to him, serve him, die, go to heaven, live happily ever after. But that isn't the last thing. Jesus is coming. The King is coming. And then we saw last week that we have to say that judgment is coming. He's coming as judge. There's going to be a greater size. And then the resurrection is coming. The church is going to be raised physically and bodily from the dead. We read that out at the graveside when we lay a Christian loved one to rest. There's a new world coming. And we want to try and learn some more about that before we finish this foundation series. And because it's so neglected, and some of the things I'm going to say I think will come as a great surprise to many of you, I think we need to spend as much time as is necessary on it. So I'll be preaching on it again next week, and even the week after that. But let's refresh our minds on some of these key scriptures. And the first one is Revelation 21. Now, you may like to just listen to me read it, or you may like to turn it up. Revelation 21, verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I'll come back to that. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain. For the old order of things has passed away. He who was seated on the throne said, I am making everything new. And they told John to write it all down. If you look at 22 and verse 12, Behold, I am coming soon, Jesus says. My reward is with me, and I will give to everyone according to what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Blessed are those who wash their robes and made them and have right to the tree of life, and so on. A new heaven and a new earth. Now, what does it mean, a new heaven and a new earth? We can imagine what a new earth might be like. Are we going to? But what about a new heaven? Well, I think it's a figure of speech in my own interpretation. I'm not going to be dogmatic. Is that what it means is that heaven is coming to the earth. Have you ever heard the expression, it was like heaven on earth? Well, that's what it's going to be. Because all the beauty and all the blessing and all the peace and all the glory of heaven is going to be here. And this world, as it were, will be turned into heaven. But it will be a new world. Heaven at the moment, I don't know where it is. I do believe it is a place. Jesus said, in my Father's house, there are many mansions or many resting places or many rooms, many condos. And I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also. He said, I came from heaven and I'm going to ascend back to heaven, but I will be coming again. Heaven is the dwelling place of God. Heaven is the headquarters of Almighty God, and that's why the Son of God returned home there and is preparing a place for all of us, but it's going to be an intermediate state, a waiting place. God is going to move his headquarters, his home, from that place, wherever it is, to this place. And the dwelling place of God will be with man on this earth. Of course, God by his nature and spirit is everywhere, but his headquarters will be here instead of there. Queen Elizabeth II in Britain, her headquarters and her throne room and her palace is called Buckingham Palace, and it's in London. So if anybody knows anything about that and they've said where is the headquarters of the British monarchy, you would say London and Buckingham Palace, but it sometimes gets transferred. In the summertime, she goes to Scotland to a castle called Balmoral. And not only does she go and the family go, but the court goes. Everybody goes, because from now on, for that period of time, she's going to operate from Balmoral and make all the decisions and sign the papers, and all the courtiers go hither and thither and do the thing that courtiers to queens have to do. There's another time part of the year, and she goes to a place called Windsor Castle, which is much closer to London. Now, as a matter of fact, the Queen goes to Windsor Castle most weekends. She rather likes it. But when she goes on a temporary visit, that's not the court going there, it's just the Queen and Prince Philip and a few friends or something. But when the court goes there, that's official. All the guards go there, and all the courtiers, and the ladies-in-waiting, and all the rest of it, and so forth. And it's not quite the same in the United States, although I do occasionally, when I'm reading the biographies of presidents, I read about the Western White House, or I read about President Truman going to Key West and an awful lot of other people having to go there with him and things being done from there. Well, the headquarters of God Almighty is in heaven, but it's going to be here, and the King is coming. New heaven, new earth, new arrangement. The other passage I turn you to, one of three, is 2 Peter and chapter 3. Let's refresh our mind on that and say something again about that. 2 Peter chapter 3. In this chapter, the Apostle Peter is reminding them of a great catastrophe that happened to the world years before. Everything changed with the great flood, the great judgment of water. And God will never do that again, but he will change the world again, and this time it will be with fire. Verse 7, by the same word the present heavens and earth are reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and destruction of ungodly men. But do not forget this one thing, dear friends, with the Lord a day is like 1,000 years, 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord isn't slow keeping his promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, that is, unexpectedly. Many people unprepared. They think it will never happen because things just seem to go on the same. The heavens will disappear with a roar. The elements will be destroyed by fire, and the earth and everything in it will be laid bare. And he goes on to say that we ought to bear that in mind, and it ought to affect the way we live as we look forward to the day of God. But then in verse 13, but in keeping with his promise, we are looking forward to a new heaven and a new earth, the home of righteousness. New heaven and a new earth. Now, is this change, this judgment, this change that's going to take place, is it going to be total destruction and annihilation of this world? Is it going to just be blown out of the sky so it doesn't exist anymore, and God is going to start all over again and build a new world? Or is it going to be this old world but renovated, restored, renewed? I'm inclined to the latter view.
I'll tell you why in a moment. But let's think of another illustration. You know, sometimes a rich man may buy a very beautiful old home in the country, an old mansion from years ago, lots of land. And he says he's going to renovate it. Now, he could bulldoze it all down. He could inspect it and say, it's hopeless. Can't do anything with it. Let's just get rid of it, erase it, burn it, remove it, get the destroyers in. And then in the middle of that now bare piece of land, I'll just build a new modern house. More often what he says is, this is a beautiful old house. Look at that marvelous woodwork. Look at those beautiful chandeliers. I'm going to keep the best of the old. But a lot of the woodwork is also rotten. I'll have to change some of the window frames and put new ones in. I'll have to put some new floors in. Those fountains don't work anymore. They need to be repaired and got going. The chandeliers are beautiful, but we need new electric wiring. It's dangerous. I'm going to have it renovated until we get the best of the old and the best of the new, and it's as near as possible perfect. And that's what God is going to do. And these are the reasons I think it's renovation rather than just doing a new world, is because in those two verses that we read, 2 Peter 3:13, that speak of a new heaven and a new earth, and Revelation 21:1, the writers do not use the word naos for new, which means new in time and origin, but the word kainos, which means new in nature or quality. You know, the Greeks often had several different words that they could choose. And it gave the nuance. And there was one word new that meant new in time or origin. Brand new, completely new. But there was another one that meant new in quality. And that's the word that's used. The second reason is because of the third passage that's a key passage. And that's Romans 8. Absolutely fascinating passage. Romans chapter 8 and verse 18 and following. Just listen to this as I read it. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed. Romans 8:18. The creation waits in eager expectation, the creation, for the sons of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration. I'm going to come back to all these things when I do the practical side. Not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope. That the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to the present time. Groaning for glory. Groaning with its pains for perfection and restoration. Not only so, but we ourselves, even believers, even Christians are part of this groaning universe, this frustration, who have the first fruits of the Spirit. We groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Hope that is seen is no hope at all. Who hopes for what he already has? But if we hope for what we do not yet have, we wait for it patiently. There seems to be a connection between the believer's resurrected body and the whole creation. And there is a connection between this old body which dies and decays and is laid to rest or burned or whatever happens to it, and the resurrection body, the new body. I don't understand it. God can do it. When Jesus rose from the dead, the tomb was empty. It was him, but with a new body. So it will be with every believer. So it will be with the whole creation. And Satan will not seem to win. God will not be saying to Satan, you have so spoiled my world that all I can do is trash it and start all over again. God will be saying to Satan, you brought evil and nastiness and ugliness and hate into my beautiful world. And I'm going to have to get rid of all of that now and make it what I ever intended it to be. And that is where we are going to live with Jesus forever. Now, what kind of a world is the new world going to be when Christ comes? A redeemed world for a redeemed people to live with the Redeemer. What will it be like? Any clues? First, it will be a world of indescribable beauty. Obviously, these things are obvious when you think about them. A world of indescribable beauty. I personally think this is a world of indescribable beauty. Louis Armstrong, Satchmo, used to sing a song, and they still play it. I heard it the other day on the radio. What a wonderful world. And he sings about green trees and red roses and babies and rainbows and people greeting each other in the street and saying, I love you. And I say to myself, what a wonderful world. Of course, we know there are some things he didn't sing about. He didn't sing about starving babies or spina bifida babies or aborted babies and say, what a wonderful world. He didn't sing about cancer and arthritis and old age, and varicose veins and decay and death and say, what a wonderful world. Because those things are not wonderful. They're ugly and awful and tragic. But God is going to remove all those things. But he's going to retain all the beautiful things and, if anything, make them even more beautiful. The best of the old. So when you see a rainbow, and when you see a beautiful flower or a sunset or the Grand Canyon, one of the most wonderful things in this world I have ever seen is the Grand Canyon. And if you have never been to the Grand Canyon, sell your shirt or whatever you have to do, or save up and see if you can't take a trip to see that. Or when you see the tidal basin and the cherry blossom in the spring of Washington, D.C., say to yourself, what a wonderful world. But how much more wonderful and beautiful it's going to be when Jesus comes. When we first took our four children, the whole family, to Switzerland, the jewel of Europe for physical beauty, we were going to go camping in the beautiful Alps. My wife and I had been there before, but the children had not. Youngest, Nicola, age 6. And as we drove through those lovely green alpine pastures and looked at the dramatic and also beautiful wooded hillsides and the lovely sparkling lakes, we were all oohing and aahing and gasping. But then all of a sudden, as we drove along the side of Lake Thun, our little 6-year-old began to cry. What she had done was spy in the distance what we had all been waiting for. She didn't know what to expect. Through the trees, through the hillsides, there the backdrop of the towering three peaks, 15,000 feet high, of the Jungfrau, the Mönch, and the Eiger, glistening white with snow. And we asked her why she was crying, and she said, I can't believe it's real. Too good to be true. And that's just what you'll say when you wake up in the kingdom of Jesus. Meanwhile, this world has its other side, pains, painful. But the Apostle Paul says in Romans 8 to Christian people, think of them as like the pains of childbirth. Painful, uncomfortable, yes, far worse than that. But at least it's going to give birth to something precious and wonderful. So first of all, it's going to be a world of indescribable beauty. Second, it's going to be a world of harmony and peace and love. Yes, sin brought disharmony and war and greed and hate. What a sad story is the history of the world of men and women, story of fighting and divisions. But it will be a time for dancing in the streets when there will be no more war ever again between anybody. And man's dreams will come true. What does it mean, someone says to me, no more sea? You said that you'd come back to that. In a beautiful world, surely there's got to be sea. I love the sea. I like to go to the sea. Lying on the beach is beautiful. How can there be no more sea? Well, it doesn't mean there won't be any more water. As a matter of fact, in its emblematic way, the book of Revelation speaks of a river flowing from the throne of God, a river of life. But you see, the book of Revelation is a book of symbols, and we have to try and interpret them. And in biblical times, the background of these writers, the sea did not mean getting a tan and lying on the beach and building sandcastles and playing with the children. I can't think of any passage, actually, in the Bible. There may be one where it speaks of that. Do you know the sea was an emblem of conflict and unrest? It seemed like as the sea roared and the tempest-tossed waves bashed against one another, it was just a picture of the nations in conflict. And there won't be any more unrest and conflict, we've said, but peace. The sea was also an emblem of a barrier. It separated nations, it separated peoples, it separated families. And you couldn't get in a jumbo jet and fly in a few hours to someone across the world. You had to go by sea, and you may never make it. For those little wooden barks were very frail against the destructive forces of the ocean. But there will be no more destruction and no more danger and no more fear. It will be a world of harmony and peace and love. Someone else says, what about that passage that says there will be no more marriage? How can it be a beautiful world and a wonderful world without marriage? Now, of course, some people are counting on that very thing for it to be a wonderful world. It all depends whether you're happily married or not. But I understand those people who feel that they can't imagine a happy world without their spouse. Well, if your spouse is a Christian, she, he will be there, of course. And if they're not, they won't be there, but you won't know. Because you will have a merciful amnesia about that. There won't be any sorrow or bad thoughts. But you see, marriage was given of God to man in his loneliness and isolation. It's God's answer, beautiful answer to man's loneliness. It was given to him so that he would have someone like him and alongside of him to love and who would love him. It was given to him so that he would be bonded with someone in a relationship that was for life, who would stand by him or her and love them in spite of the sins that they would see in that other person and the weaknesses. But in the new world, we shall all have a deep, perfect love for everyone. Nobody will be shut out of any relationship that we have with anyone else. And there will be no loneliness. That's why we believe in the Christian ethics that widowers and widows can remarry. Because there'll be no problem in the next world as to whose wife will she be or whose husband will he be. So there's no marriage or giving in marriage. There were some people in Jesus' time called the Sadducees who didn't believe in this next world and in the resurrection. Somebody once said that's why they were Sadducee, but I don't know about that. And they came to Jesus one day with a story, and they wanted to trip him up if they could. And they said, you know the Mosaic law, that if a man and woman are married and the man dies and they're childless, they have no heirs, then if he had a brother, according to the Mosaic law, that brother must marry the widow to bring fruit from and carry on the family name. And it's his obligation, he must do that. Well, they said, there were seven brothers. And since there were not seven brides for seven brothers, there were seven brothers, and the first one married this woman, but then he died childless, so the next one had to marry her, and he died, so the next one had to marry her, and so on. I think if I'd been number four, I'd begin to get a bit suspicious, wouldn't you, and start looking askance at the milkshakes. But anyway, all seven died, and then they said to Jesus, well now, in the resurrection, in the new world, whose wife will she be, since she's had seven? And Jesus just said, you don't know the scriptures, you want us do some Bible study. There will be no marriage or giving in marriage. Everybody will love everybody with a perfect love. Even animals. Sometimes people ask me, will there be animals in the new world? I don't see why not. Animals are beautiful. They were created by God. They were certainly there in paradise, in the original paradise, the perfect world before sin came in. The only thing is, and I'm just telling you this for what it's worth, I don't believe that there will be any killing or any bloodshed. I personally believe that nature has become red in tooth and claw because of the fall of man and of the universe. When we see that cruelty in nature, it's to remind us that the wages of sin is death. And that when Adam fell and began to die, and death came into the world, it affected not only Adam and Eve, mankind, it affected the whole creation, including everything below him. Turn with me to Isaiah, the book of Isaiah, and I'll just read some things to you, or you can read them with me. What about Isaiah chapter 2? You know Isaiah, forgive the way I pronounce his name, Isaiah chapter 2, he's the evangelical prophet. He was privileged to look forward to things that were to come. Now he put some things together that may be separated in time. He may have got some heavenly things on earth and some earthly things in heaven, and he may have got some things that are to do with the work of the gospel and are to be spiritually understood. I know there are different ways of interpreting these things, but just get the exciting picture. Isaiah 2, in the last days, verse 2, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all the nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Hallelujah. Chapter 11, Isaiah 11. Verse 6, the wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear, their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the hole of the cobra, and the young child put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Chapter 65 of Isaiah. Listen to this now. Isaiah 65 and verse 17. Behold, I will create new heavens and a new earth. The former things will not be remembered, nor will they come to mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in what I will create, for I will create Jerusalem to be a delight and its people a joy. Verse 20. Never again will there be in it an infant that lives but a few days, an old man who does not live out his years. And there are some things that may apply to this life. Some people talk about a millennium. I'm not getting into that because it's only 1,000 years. I'm talking about 1,000,000 years. And 1,000,000,000,000,000 years. I want to go to the last things. Well, I don't have time to read all these. I've got some other things to tell you about, but read them for yourselves. It's going to be a world of indescribable beauty. It's going to be a world of harmony and peace and love, even in nature. Third, it's going to be a world of fulfilling activity. Fulfilling activity. What will we do? Gaze at roses, love each other for 1,000,000 years? Well, even that would be better than what I was brought up on. The way, I don't know who preached all this to me, but I got the impression, I can't say that it excited me very much, that we would be sitting on a cloud, wearing a nightgown, playing a harp and singing hymns for all eternity. Well, I don't know, I don't want to be say something that I shouldn't, but that just doesn't excite me. I'm sorry, but it just doesn't excite me. I like singing hymns, but I don't think I'd like to do nothing else but sing hymns for 1,000,000 years and another 1,000,000 years. And I don't believe that's what the Bible teaches. I think it's more likely we'll be dressed in a pair of jeans digging a garden. That'll surprise you. Well, when God made his first perfect world and he put Adam and Eve in it, he told them to dig the garden. I don't think they had jeans on at that point, but we won't go into that. And he said, till the land and make it fruitful. And when sin came in, that joyful work that was just a joy and a pleasure to do, got another aspect to it. Thorns and thistles, toil, sweat of the brow. This world is frustration. The next world will be fulfillment and fruitfulness. Two activities: exploring creation and exploiting creativity. Exploring creation. If you don't make the Grand Canyon this time, maybe you'll make it in the New World and see it. Why not? Why shouldn't we take trips? We're not going to see all of this world. Nobody has seen all of this world. And it's a beautiful world. There are many things to see. I've never been to India. I don't suppose I'll ever go to India. I don't know. I'd love to go to India. How wonderful to gather a few friends together, brothers and sisters in the New World, and say, did you guys ever get to India? No, we never did. Let's go to India. Let's go see those Himalayas, as we British call them, the Himalayas. Let's go see those. Beautiful. They even make the Alps seem puny. I'd love to see those. Let's go to the Far East. Of course, there will be countries without the disease and the poverty that so many of them have today, just beauty. Let's take a trip to Australia, see some kangaroos and wallabies. I always wanted to see those, didn't you? Do you know what it says in Revelation 21, 24 to 26? The nations will walk by its light. The kings of the earth will bring their splendor to it. The glory and honor of the nations will be brought into it. What does it mean? Well, we can only speculate. But wouldn't it be wonderful if it means this, that all the best of all the different nations that there have ever been, all the best that those nations ever achieved by the God-given creativity that God invested in them will still be there and will be brought to us to see, or we can go and see it. And all the best of all the cultures of the centuries and millennia past, the greatest achievements, we can go and see them like we do now when we go to Greece and go to the Acropolis and see what's left of the Parthenon. Marvel at a previous age and a previous culture. There's so much to learn. I was at a think tank the other day and the speakers were all experts on a particular thing. And I thought, you know, I would have loved to have been an expert on something. I'd love to have perhaps been an academic where I could just pursue all my life this one thing and keep adding to my knowledge and have read everything that was ever written on it and really do some research and get into it. I almost envied those people. But won't be this life. Why not the next? Oh, aren't there so many different worlds that we would like to get into? But there isn't time. Oh yes, there is in the New World. Exploring creation and exploiting creativity. What potential you have that has never been fulfilled, but will be. I used to ask a friend, we prayed for each other one thing every day. He said, what do you want me to pray for you? And I said that I will fulfill my potential. And after a while, I thought, what a silly thing to ask for this life. And now he prays for me that I will fulfill the calling and the purpose for which God put me in this world until he calls me home. But my potential will only be fulfilled in the new world, the new heaven and the new earth. Because even the least gifted of us has millions more potential than we'll ever fulfill and achieve in this life. We're limited by time. We've only one life to live. We have to choose one thing and reject the others, usually. We're limited by resources. We cannot afford this and we cannot afford that. We're limited by opportunity. We may not have had parents who gave us horse riding lessons and sent us to music lessons and on and on and on. We just hear these things. We wish I'd had that opportunity. You will. Why not? I think there's going to be music in the next world. Of course there is. There's music in heaven. And choirs and instruments and singing. You know, when I went to college, that's my time. When I went to college, they told me I had to do two majors. I said, I can only do divinity. could only do the Bible. I can't do anything else. I was thrown out of school when I was 16. And I'm trying to get back now, and I've learned my lesson, and I want some qualifications, but I can only do one major. And they said, oh no, you have to do two. Well, anyway, cut a long story short, they said I had to do art. Art? I never painted anything in my life except a wall. I can't do art. So they sent me to the art tutor. And he had so few students, he would take anybody, because if he didn't, his department would be closed down. So he took me. And do you know, by the time I'd finished 3 years doing art, somebody stole all my paintings. I didn't know whether to be upset or flattered. Somebody stole all my paintings. And I've only painted two little pictures since. My wife is always saying, I wish you would paint. I wish you would draw. Sometimes at birthdays, she buys me some things to nudge me. I don't know why, I just have never kind of got to it. I look at a Renoir, and I know I could never paint like that, but I look at some other things and I think, gracious me! Do me a favor, I could do that. So my wife says, why don't you? Well. And don't you feel, I'm trying to be practical, I want you to be excited about the future. Don't you feel sometimes there's so much in you that you could do if only you had time and opportunity, the talent's there, it's in there, and you so feel frustrated? Of course you do. We groan. We groan with the rest of creation, waiting for the adoption of our bodies as sons and the renovation of the new universe, and when the King comes, and then see what I can do to the glory of God. That's what we're waiting for. Next week I'm going to talk about some more things that we will be doing. Responsible service. Enjoyable pleasures. Oh yes. Pleasures. Inspiring worship. And all these things for the glory of God. Question one, are you ready? Is your name in the Lamb's Book of Life? Have you got that passport? Are you a citizen of Christ's kingdom now and coming? Many will be shut out. Now is the day to get your name down and to make sure. Oh, people around you will scoff. They'll say, what a ridiculous. That's just wishful thinking, fantasizing. But we know that it's never going to happen in this real world. No, it's going to happen when the King comes. When the King comes and the Prince of Peace comes and the King of Righteousness comes. And the Bible says so. And I believe that the very fact that we have this desire, this groaning, these pains, these longings, we sing these songs, is itself an indication that there is a better world and a new world and a coming world. Are you ready? Are you excited? Of course, you may prefer the nightgown and the cloud and the harp. Well, take your choice. As for me, I know what I'm looking forward to, and I find it all here in the Bible. And it should make a difference now. In view of this, we don't write the world off. We don't give it to the devil. We don't give it to the warmongers and the haters and everything. We say, this is God's world. And I'm going to do everything I can to leave this world a better place than I found it. Because the renovation, in a way, has already begun. That's what God is. But when Jesus comes, it will be made perfect. And so will I. And that hope makes all the difference to the way we live now. Try it, and you'll see it's true. For his name's sake.